Can you hear me? Okay, so thank you all for coming again to the second talk, which will be on the title that was just announced, and it is based on a couple of joint papers. One with Dan Florentin and Vitaly Milman. Dan is was our MSc student, joint MSc student, and also on a joint project with Boaz Slomka, who is here today. So let me start by recalling a fundamental theorem of affine geometry, which you're probably acquainted with. So if there is a function from Rn to Rn, and you know that it maps any three points on a line to three points on a line, so collinear points to collinear points, and if you add to that some non-degeneracy condition, for example, you ask it to be bijection, but you can actually ask much more. So you can ask for the image of the mapping not to be contained in one line. That's actually enough if it's injected, say. But anyway, let's say a bijection, because this is what we'll be working with today mainly. Then once you know that collinear points are mapped to collinear points, then this implies that the mapping is linear. This is the fundamental theorem of affine geometry. Somehow it's more familiar in the context of projective geometry, and we'll get there. But in affine geometry, this is a theorem. And this talk will revolve around two variants of this theorem, one which is known and comes up in studying order isomorphisms, and the other which is new, and I will talk about it. And the first one, which I alluded to in the first talk, comes up when you regard the same kind of mappings, say segments to segments, that's easier to think than collinear points to collinear points, but instead of all of Rn, the mappings are defined only on a subset. Okay, so you can start thinking what happens there. The second regards mappings which are from Rn to Rn, but you don't assume that lines are mapped to lines in all directions, but only, say, in some fixed directions that you think about in advance. So these will be sort of the two topics of this talk, but let me give the introduction and how you come to these kinds of questions, and this will also connect things with the previous talk. So today we'll go a little bit more into detail in some of the things I talked about in the first talk, but I will try to make it revolve around these two theorems. So we defined what's an order reversing isomorphism. So you have some partially ordered set S, and you have a bijection from S to itself, and you assume that it, say, reverses order. Sometimes you also assume that it's an involution, so that when you apply it twice, you get the original object. This is less important. But what's important is really that it's a bijection. So an involution is automatically a bijection, but usually you just need a bijection. And, okay, this is from my last talk. So we became interested in characterizing these kinds of isomorphisms, so for certainly partially ordered sets connected with convexity. And also, like I said in the first talk, so actually once you have some order reversing isomorphism, then characterizing all of them is the same as characterizing all of order preserving isomorphisms. So actually in this talk I will talk about order preserving isomorphisms, although our original interest came from duality questions and from order reversion. Okay, but in this talk I will almost only talk about order preserving. Note that it's not always the same, because like it's written here, if you know one order reversing isomorphism, then it's the same. If you don't know if one exists at all, then you can't use this analogy, and then there are some, but usually you can understand what's going on. Okay, so part one, we call it order isomorphisms on windows. So let me first introduce some notation. CVX of K will denote convex functions, but when the domain is not all of Rn, but some usually closed convex set K. Okay, sometimes bounded, sometimes unbounded, that's less important. So this is CVX of K, and we think of them as convex functions defined on a window, because you may think that you have a big convex function, but you only see it on a window. Or you can think that your convex function is plus infinity outside this convex set. It doesn't really matter how you prefer to think about it. And another thing that I will use just a little bit is these geometric convex functions. So if you assume that 0 is inside your window, you can look at the subclass of functions which are 0 at 0 and non-negative. And this is an important class geometrically. We discussed it in the first talk. I will discuss it, but just a little bit of this. Okay, so like I said, so look at these convex functions on a window, and we want to characterize what are order-preserving transforms from from this set to itself, or maybe to a different window. Okay, so convex of K1 to convex of K2. And again, the partial order is given for functions by pointwise inequality. So two functions, a function f is less than or equal to g if and only if at every point f of x is less than or equal to g. Okay, so which order preserving transforms do we expect? Which order isomorphism? And for simplicity, assume that you have the same set, so from one window to itself. So of course, you have the identity mapping. You can also, it's probably here, linear ones. You have the identity mapping, or you can multiply by 5, or you can add a linear function to all of your functions and order isomorphism. But what else? Do you expect anything else? So to see what we expect, this will also show you like parts of the proof of theorems I talked about last time. So I'll show you what you start doing. Okay, so the simplest thing, you start by looking at delta functions. Delta functions are very simple convex functions. They're equal to a constant at some point and a plus infinity everywhere else. They're part of our class of functions, at least if x0 is in our set K. If not, it's just a plus infinity function. And you want to know where these are mapped to. Okay? So it's pretty easy to see that they have to be mapped to delta functions. Why is that? Because they're extremal in some sense. In which sense? Well, here is a sense in which they're extremal. If you have two functions above a delta function, then they must be comparable. Because they must be the same delta function with a different constant, right? So this is an extremal property that has to do only with the order, with nothing else. And therefore, it has to be preserved. So a function satisfying this must be mapped to a function satisfying this. And delta functions are the only function satisfying this. Above any function which is not the delta function, you can find two incomparable functions. Okay, so delta functions are mapped to delta functions, and this gives you a mapping from Rn plus 1, well, not from Rn plus 1, this is a mistake, from your base set times R to itself, from delta functions to delta function. And delta function, you can think about it as the point, this single point, which is x0 comma c, this point in Rn plus 1. Okay, so you have a point map. And okay, this is just something to notice, that when talking about geometric convex functions, delta functions are no longer members of this set, because they're not 0 at 0, unless they're a specific delta function. So this doesn't work, but you have to work with slightly more sophisticated extremal properties. So this was a very trivial extremal property. You have to come up with a different one, and you can do that. So this is just a side remark. Okay, so we continue with these delta functions. So I write routine methods by now because we've done it in several different situations, and it's not difficult to show that this point map from delta functions to delta functions is maps intervals to intervals, in particular maps collinear points to collinear points. You do that. And also that once you know where delta functions go, you know where everything goes. And that's also simple, right? Because the function is determined by all the delta functions above it, they determine what the function is. So if you know where all delta functions go to, and if you know that order is preserved, then you know your transform. Okay, so you see that we're in the framework of the fundamental theorem of affine geometry. So if your base set was all of Rn, then you'd actually have a point map on Rn plus 1, which maps intervals to intervals, which is a bijection. And since n is at least 2, because the dimension is the dimension of your base plus 1, this extra dimension is the value of the function, then you would guess that the mapping must be linear. So this is actually almost the full proof of one of the theorems that I spoke about on Friday. And here's the theorem. So I wrote a theorem for duality, actually. There is a unique duality on the class of all convex functions up to a linear term. And this unique duality is the Legendre transform. Okay, so here I'm rewriting the three ingredients. First, you compose your map, the order reversing map, with the Legendre transform. Okay, then you get an order preserving bijection. Then here, the second part, what I explained to you now is that you show delta functions are mapped to delta functions. But actually, if you talk about all of Rn, there's another family of extremal functions, very simple, and these are linear functions. Okay, so here, because I sort of copied it from a different place, it's written for linear functions. So linear functions have this dual extremal property. Any two functions below a linear function must themselves be the same linear function up to constants, so they must be comparable. So linear functions are mapped to linear functions. And then the way all these linear functions join up, if you show that intervals are mapped to intervals, you use the fundamental theorem of affine geometry. And again, one reason I wrote it like this is that you should already note that linear functions, In the case of a bounded domain, they are no longer extremal. So you can have different functions, different linear functions with different slopes under a linear function. So they're no longer extremal. And this already you can see a difference between the bounded case, between a convex body case, and the case of Oliver. Okay, but this is basically the proof of the theorem in the previous slide. Okay, so I'm going back one slide backwards. So like I said, we have this point map on delta functions, and the transform is induced by it, but now you have a mapping not from all of Rn plus 1, but from a subset. Now, this K1 here is your base set K times R. So it's a little misleading that I wrote K1. But the question, you can write it, you can state it with any two sets. If you have a function from some subset of Rn, Rn plus 1, some subset of the vector space finite dimensional to another subset, and you know that it maps interval to intervals, what must it look like, right? Which version of the fundamental theorem holds for subsets? Okay, and so for some of you, the answer appears right away, and some have to think about it a little bit more. But here it is. It comes from projective geometry, and it has to be a projective... In projective space, it has to be a linear map. So in Rn, you think about it as a fractional linear map. And this is the fundamental theorem for subsets, and it's sort of well known. I will say references in a little bit. Okay, so the fractional linear map just means it's linear in the numerator and a linear function in the denominator. Okay, and of course your subset K, this has to be defined on K, so K has to be included where x dot v2 is not equal minus v. Okay, and in the same way that the fundamental theorem of affine geometry worked for the case of all convex functions, then this theorem comes up when you talk about windows. And you get this theorem for order isomorphisms for functions on windows, and this is part of Dan-Filletti's MSc thesis. So all order isomorphisms on functions defined on a convex subset are given by actually point maps on their epigraph. So epigraph is... this also appeared in my first talk. This is epigraph of the function. And of course, there are certain restrictions on this capital F because it has to map graphs of functions to graphs of epigraphs of functions to epigraphs of functions. But this is really the only restriction. Okay, and now the same theorem holds when you talk about geometric complex functions. So like I said, you have to use a little more and a little slightly more sophisticated extremal family, but this can be done. And of course, this may be not satisfactory the way I've written it because you can't really see the transform in your eyes. So, but you can compute the formula from these F. So I just gave a few examples in this next slide. So, okay, a transform given this way, so the epigraph of TS is F, some fractional linear map of the epigraph of F. So here's one example when F is given by, so x dot y, x comma y moves to x over y, 1 over y. Okay, x is n-dimensional, y is one-dimensional, of course. Then what you get is this J transform that we spoke about in the last lecture. So I'm not going to go back to there, but you get this quite interesting transform. If your fractional linear map is like this, so x over x1 plus 1, y over x1 plus 1. What's special here is that the linear function in the denominator does not include y. Okay, this is a rather special case. In this case, this is the transform you get. Okay, so t of f is f evaluated x over 1 minus x1 times 1 minus x1. Now look, this is very strange. Well, I think it's a little bit strange because what you see here is a linear function times a convex function. And this is bijective, so you get all convex functions on some subset by this formula. But notice that it's not just f is a convex function, but you evaluate it at some point. So without this linear term, this will not be a convex function. So it's a little bit strange what's going on here, but it's true nonetheless. So this is a bijective transform from wherever it's defined, so x greater than x1 greater than minus 1, to somewhere else, actually, to some other subset of Rn, some other hyperplane, some functions defined on some other half space, okay, but it's bijective from here to there. Okay, and more generally, when the denominator does not include y, then this is the more general formula. You don't really have to look at it. Just notice that it's always like this. It's your function evaluated at sum. Now, f1 is this guy. It's again, a fractional linear map. So it's your function evaluated at sum. Well, it's the inverse of a fractional linear map, which is, again, a fractional linear map, times a linear factor. So this is the general formula when the denominator does not include y. When it does include y, you get something much stranger, like this J transform. And, of course, these things can be combined, because it doesn't have to include either just y or just x. It can include both of them. Okay, well, these are more or less the two different phenomena that can come up. Okay, so now a few words about this fundamental theorem for subsets. So essentially, it's a theorem for projective geometry. And essentially, the theorem in projective geometry says that if you have a map on projective space, which preserves projective intervals, which are, of course, thinking of them in Rn plus 1, it's planes, on a subset, then you can always extend it to such a collineation in projective space, which is defined on the whole space, and then use the fundamental theorem there to say that it's linear. Okay, so this we found it in this paper of Schiffman, and this extension is done using the Zell theorem, but Schiffman's paper is much more generally does some different things I will talk about later. So I don't know, maybe it can be found somewhere else as well. We reproved this in some kind of a different manner, so let me give you a little bit of the flavor of our proof. So what do I want to show? So basically, one can check that these fractional linear maps, this special type of maps, on the plane, they are four transitive. So you can map any four points, say, in convex position, like this, when one is in the triangle that the other three construct. They can be mapped to any other four points in such a position. Okay, so you may as well assume that you have four points and that they are fixed, because you can apply a fractional linear map and then get this. And now what I want to show is that all of the points are fixed. Okay, so in other words, the identity mapping after we apply this fractional linear map, which thus has to be the inverse of our map. Okay, so let's assume that these four blue points, which are in convex position, they are fixed. And assume that there is some point which is not fixed. So let's assume it's on the boundary. Once you know all the boundary points are fixed, it's not difficult to show that also the interior is fixed. Yes. Okay, and I remind you that our map preserves intervals. Okay, maps intervals to intervals. Okay, so what I do is you take the two closest points on this boundary, which are closest to the point that you know is not mapped to itself. Okay, so they are still blue. They are the two closest points which are still fixed. Okay, and since it's an open set, the points which are not fixed, then there are such closest points. Okay, and now you know that the interval between these two blue points is fixed. It doesn't mean that every point of it is fixed, but the interval is mapped to itself, because it's not hard to show that endpoints are mapped to endpoints. Okay, and then you get this another interval between two blue points has to be mapped to itself, and then an intersection of two intervals which are mapped inside themselves must be mapped to itself, because it must be mapped to a point which is on both intervals, and there's just one such point, the intersection point. So you get this other blue point, the intersection. And okay, here's another line between two blue points and another one, and you get another blue point which is mapped to itself. And now you can construct this line which has to be mapped to itself, and therefore you've found a point which is closer to the red one than allowed, which is mapped to itself, and this is a contradiction. Okay, so this is a proof. It's not the only one, but I think it's pretty simple. Right. A few more words about fractional linear maps. I should say that our general feeling is that fractional linear maps in the context of convexity have not received enough attention, not enough that we'd even hear about them much before we started to work on this. And so we really wanted to understand how they work, not just for order isomorphisms. We think they will play a bigger role in coming years in our field. So here's something about them. So generally, when you have a fractional linear map, you have this kind of defining hyperplane. It's actually where the function is not defined, right? It's where the denominator is zero. And it so happens that if you take a cone which emanates from this hyperplane, that it is mapped to a cylinder emanating from the hyperplane. It's not necessarily a plane hyperplane, only for this very specific map it is. But it is mapped to a cone emanating from the hyperplane where the inverse is not defined, or where the which is not inside the image. The image is always two halves, I mean, space minus a hyperplane. Okay, and vice versa. So cylinders will be mapped to cones. On hyperplanes, which are parallel to this H, it's of course linear because the denominator is fixed. And basically, you just have, I mean, if you want to study these, you just have one that you have to study because all of them are equivalent to this one up to affine maps composed from the right and the left. Okay, so this is one, x over x1 minus 1. It's a nice one because it's the inverse of itself, and these two hyperplanes are the same, but it's okay. And this is a slide that I also had in my first talk, so fractional linear maps and convexity, they really turn out quite naturally in convexity. Because if you take the translation of a convex body by some fixed constant and then take the dual, this is no other than a fractional linear map of the dual and the fractional linear map given by this formula up here. So x over 1 plus x naught dot x. Okay, and also if you apply the same to a k-dual, you get the second identity. And then here I prepared a slide to show this. So if you start with a convex body, I'll use the first... So you start with the convex body, say the cube, you take its dual, you get this guy, L1, you move it. So notice that I moved it and I kept the origin inside so I can take a dual and nothing terrible happens. So here's the dual. And this dual by this formula is no other than just taking this cube and taking a fractional linear map for which the defining hyperplane is this guy here. You can check. So, and you can sort of see that it's a mapping of the cube. It does look very much like the cube. And here's another example. So you start with the same cube here. You take the dual, it's L1. But then let's move it all the way so the zero is on its boundary. Then the dual is, of course, unbounded. And this is exactly taking this fractional linear map. Of course, X0 is now different because I moved it differently. But taking a fractional linear map with respect to this defining hyperplane, which is touching the cube. So now you get something unbounded. Okay. Illustration of what these maps can do. Now, there are all sorts of questions which one may ask, and I'm not going to go into all of them because I still have the second subject that I want to talk to you about. So one question you can ask is which bodies are fractional linear images of a given body? And you can say some things. So for example, a combinatorial structure, like you saw in this example, is preserved if you have a certain number of vertices, and also the image will have the same number of vertices, and well, all the combinatorial structure. And also ellipsoids are mapped to ellipsoids. This is not difficult to see because they're conical sections. And if you think about it in the projective world, then a conical section, by a linear map, it's mapped to a conical section. And this can also lead you to think a little bit about hyperbolic space, about just living inside the Euclidean ball, and say taking the Klein model where you have lines as geodesics, and these fractional linear maps map line to line. So of course they are Möbius transformations. There's nothing really, really new here, just it wasn't really considered somehow in our field so much. Another question which you might ask is sort of the similar question. So when are the only fractional linear maps of a body onto, say, itself? Do they have to be linear? So, for example, in the cube, this is the case, and also in the cross-polytope. So you cannot map a cube to itself or a cross-polytope to itself with a fractional linear map, which is not just a symmetry, which is not linear. And also, if you force the origin to be mapped to itself, then any symmetric body is the only fractional linear maps mapping into itself are linear ones. Okay, for example, an ellipsoid to an ellipsoid, but keeping the origin, it has to be linear. Okay, so this is a whole big subject, and I will now stop with it. I'm almost halfway through my talk. And the second part is I want to talk about the fundamental theorem, but not on a subset, a different kind of generalization, if you like. Now we're going to talk about a fixed number of directions. Okay. And this is joint work with Bart Smock. So the motivation for this second part, we're still talking about order isomorphism, but now we've moved to the simplest setting of order isomorphisms one could think about. That's taking a n-dimensional vector space with a vector ordering, meaning just a cone. Okay, and you want to know what are order isomorphisms of this cone, mappings from Rn to Rn, which preserve the order of this cone. And these kind of questions were studied for rather specific cones, so Alexander considered light cones. They're not exactly cones, light cones, but never mind. And some special kind of cone called non-angular cones were studied by Zeeman and Otthaus. And let me tell you the theorem about Kant, and then we'll get to the version of the fundamental theorem of affine geometry. So this is not yet the theorem, this is the beginning. So you fix a cone, K, here I drew one. You want it to be non-degenerate, meaning just that it has, let's say it has a volume and a slope. And maybe you want it a little bit even more non-degenerate, so that it really gives a real order on the space. And then assume you have an order isomorphism, so a map which preserves order. Here, of course, you have a very trivial order reversion, just minus sign. Okay, and I just remind those of you who forgot what is a cone ordering. So x is less than or equal to y with respect to the cone k means that y minus x is in k. So here are two points. You want to see if y, let's say y is the one which is higher up and to the right. You want to know if y is greater than or equal to x. You draw the line between them. You move it to the origin. And if it's inside the cone, then indeed y is greater than or equal to x. If now I change y, I move it to the origin. And this second y is not greater than or equal to x. Okay, this is cone ordering, very static. Okay, so which kind of order isomorphisms exist for cones? Here's an example. Take the cone to be just one octant, the positive octant. R plus, let's say we're in R3, so R plus times R plus times R plus. And take your transformation to be just some monotone function, let's say even a continuous monotone function on each of the coordinates. This is clearly an order isomorphism with respect to this order. This order is just pointwise order on the coordinates. Very simple. Okay, so we have an example. So what could be the theorem? The theorem is that essentially this is the only example. So first of all, if K is not such a cone, it's not so degenerate. So what does it mean? We want it to have more than n extremal rays. Extremal rays is what you imagine, the extremal vectors of the cone. And this guy has exactly 3. Or in dimension n has exactly n, and we wanted to have more than n, so at least n plus 1. And I wrote with some parentheses because I want it to have at least n plus 1, each n of which are independent. So I don't want it to have, each n of which are independent. So if k is like this, is any different than the cone I just wrote, then t must be linear. The only order isomorphisms in this case are linear ones. Of course, not just any linear one. It has to also preserve the cone. Another restriction, but it must be linear. And also in this case, we know that actually the example I wrote here is the only example. So if your cone is like this, it just has n extremal rays, then in the right basis where your cone is written like this, your mapping has to be diagonal, just the way I wrote it here, okay, as in this example. So this is the theorem. And let's see what comes in the proof and how we get to this fundamental theorem I was alluding to before. So in the proof, what you first show is that extremal rays are mapped to extremal rays. So you already see these lines that are mapped to lines. Okay? And you can also show the translations of extremal rays are mapped to translations of extremal rays. So you have all these lines which are mapped to lines, but they're not in all directions. They're just in the directions of the extremal rays. So you have this fixed number of directions. Maybe it's infinite. Maybe your cone is this nice ice cream cone, but still it's not all directions. You'll never get all directions as the extremal rays of a cone. Okay, so what you need is fundamental theorem for a finite number of directions. We went looking for one of these, and we couldn't really find one, so we had to prove one. So here it is. Assume you have a mapping from Rn to itself. Assume it's a bijection. Of course, you can ask about relaxations of this, and I won't even remember what we do know, we don't know. Let's think it's a bijection. And let's fix n plus 1 generic lines. Generic means, again, that each n of them are linearly independent. Okay. And assume that your mapping maps lines to lines for all lines which are parallel to any of these n plus 1. Okay? So you have these n plus 1 families of all parallel lines in these directions, x plus li. And assume that each of these is mapped to a line. And I assume that it's mapped to a full line. Okay? So it's a little bit more than just collinear points to collinear points, even in these directions, because you want a full line to be mapped to a full line. But if you know this, then your f is affine additive. So if you assume the origin is mapped to itself, your map is an additive map. Okay. Now notice that I said additive. I didn't say linear. I'm not assuming continuity or anything. That's one of the nice things about these fundamental theorems is you don't assume continuity, and you still get linear maps. So here you can't get linear maps. Okay. And just one more sentence before that. So it means that if you want to check if your map is additive, you don't have to check that all lines are mapped to lines, but just a quite small subfamily, all parallel lines in these n plus 1 directions, which you fixed in advance. Okay, and now what I wanted to say about additivity. So you cannot deduce linearity and not additivity as in the standard fundamental theorem, because you can write up an example, f of x 1 up to xn will just be f of x 1 up to f of xn, okay, with the same f. And if this f is additive, then it's not hard to check that this mapping maps all lines in rational directions to lines. Okay, but still, because there exist these additive maps which are not linear, you don't really get a linear map. So these are crazy maps, so any small regularity you put on your map, then it can't be this one, but you have to take this into consideration. Please stop me if there are any questions. This is the second lecture, so less formal, I think, I've heard. Must it be less formal?
I mean, how general is an additive which is not linear?
How general is an additive map which is not linear? Well, it's, you know, it's linear on the rationals, and it's, yeah, you have to fix it on a Hamel basis, but that's all.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, it has to be.
If it's measurable.
Yes, no, that of course, but, okay, well, maybe we'll get to something similar. Okay, so like I said, continuous version will say that your mapping is affine, and actually here you really don't need that the line is mapped onto a line, but it's enough to assume collineation in this direction. So like I said, collineation, if you think about it, just means that the line is mapped into a line. You don't have to assume that it's mapped onto the line, just into it. And in the continuous version, this is enough. And you get an affine map. And you just have to check these n plus 1 directions, generic directions. Now, a few remarks. So first of all, there is a very big difference whether you know in advance that parallel lines are mapped in these directions, are mapped to parallel lines, or you just know that lines are mapped to lines. If you know that parallel lines are mapped to parallel lines, it makes everything much easier. Now, in the projective setting, and we'll get to there, so I will talk about the projective setting. In the projective setting, this is forced. So you automatically somehow get this parallel is mapped to parallel, and we will see this a little bit later. And also in many applications, it's sort of automatic. Like in this cone application, we actually had it. So we proved it before. We proved this more general version of the fundamental theorem because we knew a priori that parallel lines are mapped to parallel lines in these directions. Okay, and then things more or less work by induction. Of course, you have to do this cleverly, but you can. And when this is not assumed, when your lines are just mapped to any lines, then the proof is more interesting. Let me show you a first lemma, which already shows you that things become a little bit more interesting. So if you want to go by induction, why not first take a mapping from the plane to Rn and then add your directions and see how things work out. So if you have a mapping from the plane to Rn, which maps lines to lines in two given directions, and for simplicity, I assume the directions were E1 and E2. So all lines which are parallel to the x-axis are mapped to lines, and all lines which are parallel to the y-axis are mapped to lines. So in this case, the image of this map essentially can be either a plane, so maybe your map is sort of linear, and then the image is, it's linear, and then the image is a plane, but it can also be this guy. So this is the, I always forget, hyperbolic paraboloid. Okay, one of these guys. It's this guy. So you can write ft and f times t, but you can also add these maps, f of s, g of t, and f of s times g of t, up to linear variance. Of course, you can translate it, you can do some linear thing to it, but up to this, your mapping has to be of this form. Okay, so this is the first lemma in the direction of proving the theorem. And here is its generalization to k dimensions. So, you don't really have to read this. It's just like you saw before, st and s times t. So I have str, s times t, s times r times t, and s times r times t. All these guys can play a role. Of course, it's not just s, it's f of s, g of r, h of t, whatever. And you can combine these guys, any linear combination. So that's what's written here. U delta are vectors. And you have these any products with any term either appearing or not appearing any number of times.
What are the
FIs here? So FIs are bijections from R to R.
Nothing else.
No. Yes, there are bijections from R to R. Well, you could probably assume that f of 0 is 0 and f of 1 is 1. Fi of 0 is 0. And now what's the next step? So in our proof, the next step is showing that, okay, now if we're from Rn to Rn and we add another direction, then only the linear terms in this guy survive. So this is a little bit more difficult, and I'm not showing this, but what you get is basically this. So if you know, for example, that the standard, that lines parallel to all the axes are mapped to lines, and then you have another family of parallel lines which are mapped to lines, say the family parallel to the line 1, 1, 1, 1, then your mapping up to translation by f of 0, of course, has to be this type. So some fixed function, which is a bijection from R to R, and diagonal. Okay, so this is the general form. Okay, what is this doing here? Okay, this was supposed to remind me of applications. Okay, this is clearly not supposed to be here. So maybe some of you can already think of applications of this theorem. So generally, any place where you use the fundamental theorem, then our theorem says that basically you can use much less. So you only have to check lines in given or in fixed n plus 1 directions. So when does this come up? For example, it comes up in our analysis of order isomorphisms for functions. So you can imagine a case where the functions that you want to look at, say, this is just an example, are functions which are convex and minimum in 0. Okay, so when you have these functions, then you get all sorts of linear parts, which you presumably can show that are mapped to linear, but then you don't get all linear. You can't get a line like this, right? Because it has to be a convex function which is 0 and 0. So you need a fundamental theorem for just positive slopes, and our theorem gives that. There are all sorts of situations where this theorem can help. Okay? And here a little bit about the projective point of view, because I've noticed it's of interest usually to people. So let me remind you what is a projective space, what's in which model I'm working. So a point will be a line through the origin. We're embedding, we're living in Rn plus 1, and our points are lines through the origin. The usual fundamental theorem is that if, so collinear points are now lines which are on a plane through 0. And the usual fundamental theorem says that if all these collinear points are mapped to collinear points, then the mapping has, and it's non-degenerate, then the mapping has to be linear, meaning it's induced by, so projective linear, induced by linear map on all of R. Okay? So now you can embed, of course, this is how we usually think about it, especially with respect to this first part of the talk of the maps on windows. So we put our Rn, we put it in type 1, okay, and then any line intersects it, except for lines which lie in projective space of one dimension smaller, which like the line at infinity, or no, well, okay, except for these. And of course, any two projective lines, this is a nice thing about projective space, so you don't have this parallel, things can't be parallel, any two projective lines, it intersects at a projective point. So if you don't have parallel, then what will be the analog of our parallel lines? Well, of course, if you look at this Rn up there, and you look at parallel lines, then they correspond to projective lines, to subspaces of dimension 2, which all pass through one line. A line is a point, so which all pass through one point. We call this guy a star, and okay, here's a picture. So these parallel lines in Rn, they correspond, there is one point in this projective space of one dimension less, and it's like a book. Okay, it's all these planes which pass through these lines. And now, of course, this is just one family of parallel lines. Now you can take a linear transformation of it, okay, and you get all these planes which pass through a different point. And then if you, so what corresponds to the parallel lines that we had before, up there it will now be a star. This is why we call this a star. Okay, because usually it's a star. Only when this line lies in RPN minus 1, only then it will be parallel points. Okay, so in some sense, in the projective world, you're not supposed to distinguish between parallel lines and a star like this in Rn. So, and this is the right point of view. So in the projective context, okay, some references. Just usually people worked in dimension 2, and results in this spirit are, for example, obtained by Planovich. And then Schiffman, who we also considered in the first part of the talk, he did this when you don't consider all directions, but an open set of directions. So lines, an open set of lines, actually. Which is quite general, but it's different than what we do, because our set is very discrete. It's very non-open. And it should be said that Schiffman also did put both things together. So he considered just not all directions, just an open set of directions, and for a bounded domain. And then, like I said in the first part, he was able to extend whatever. Okay, so here is our theorem. I see that things moved a little bit. Sorry, I wrote it on one slide. It's a couple of theorems together. So assume you're in projective space and you have n plus 2 actually points, so p0 up to pn plus 1, and assume that they are non-degenerate in one of the following two ways. So one way is that n plus 1 of them are very non-generic, because n plus 1 of them lie in an n-dimensional subspace, but in this n plus dimensional subspace I want each n of them to be linearly independent, and then you add another one, which is linearly independent of the rest, so which is actually upstairs. This is one setting, and then the other one is that you actually have, linearly independent ones. Okay, I should probably draw this. So one setting is in which you have, you imagine it like this. So one setting is in which you have n plus 1 in the base, which gives you these n plus 1 families of parallel lines here, so you can apply our theorems. And then you have another one. And another one is actually should be thought of as a star over here. This is one setting. And then the other setting is when you have just n over here, and then you have two stars. Okay. So in these two settings, when lines from this fact, so a line now is, of course, a two-dimensional subspace passing through this line, projective line. So when lines in these families are mapped to lines, then you know that your mapping must be linear. Okay, something that I didn't say is that here automatically parallel are mapped to parallel. If you assume that, I'm not being very clear, I'm sorry. In the projective setting, and this I promised before, in the projective setting, you have this kind of a family of parallel lines, which are mapped to a family of parallel lines, then of course, which are mapped to lines, and this point has to be mapped somewhere. And then all lines through it are mapped to lines through it, so you automatically get that parallel lines are mapped to parallel lines, or at least to a star, but okay, so you get this thing which is preserved in the projective setting, it has to be preserved, which we didn't have in Rn, so it's actually much simpler to work in the projective setting. Of course, different things come up. But. And this is a theorem, that either one of these two kinds of families, if you know that lines are mapped to lines in these directions, then you know that your mapping must be linear, must be projective linear, must be induced by linear. Okay, another remark which may be of interest to some people is that all these results, they actually apply above any field. Finite fields are usually of special interest, except for Z2, which is always problematic. Those of you who know this subject. Now, applications, like I said, there are a lot, but I don't know if it's so interesting to say them here. So, for example, there's this proof of Alexandrov called the fundamental theorem of chronogeometry about light cones. And this theorem really simplifies that proof, because, again, instead of checking all lines, it's enough to check a very small family of lines. Let me state another simple application. It's based on this result of Gardner and Maldin. And this is a particular case of their result, a very simple one, but it's very easy to show, so I thought I'd show it. Here is a theorem. If you have a bijection which sends circles to circles on the plane, say, but an Rn, whatever, then it has to be linear. Okay. And here is a proof. So you have this bijection which sends circles to circles, and you want to show that it's affine. So what you're going to show is that it's a collineation. It maps collinear points to collinear points. So you take three non-collinear points, and you want to show that their inverse image has to be non-collinear points. Okay? Because this will exactly show that if you have three collinear points, they cannot be mapped to non-collinear points. And of course, if you have three non-collinear points, there is a circle between them. It is the image of some other circle. So the pre-images of these three points cannot be collinear. Okay, this is a extremely simple proof. It actually shows that. What does it show? Okay, I'm sorry, I'm a little bit confused. I'm not sure it shows exactly what I said, but this, let me go to the next slide, of which I am completely sure. I wrote this just now. So here is the generalization of their theorem. What I just said wasn't special for, it may have been not exactly correct, but the idea is not special for circles. It's families which have a certain property, which is written here. So assume you have a bijection from Rn to Rn, and you have this class of geometric objects, and we call it C. Okay, actually, you're supposed to have two classes, one in the domain and one in the range, but let's assume that it's the same class, just like here with circles to circles. Okay? And now, what do we assume on this bijection? So assume that, first, what do we assume in the class? So assume that the class satisfies that every three non-collinear points have some element in the class which includes them. This is true, for example, for circles. It's also true for triangles. Every three non-collinear points have a member of the class which includes all of them. And then you also assume that no element of the class contains three collinear points. So this is true for circles. And now, because of our theorem, you don't have to assume it for all the collinear points, but you just have to assume that no element of your class contains three collinear points in one of n plus one fixed directions which you fixed in advance. Okay, so this is the strengthening of the theorem. You don't have to, something weaker about your class. And then the theorem says that if your function maps elements in this class onto elements in this class, here you have to assume a little bit more, so you have to assume that any element of the class is attained as the image of some element in the same class. So for some reason I assume it's the same class in the domain and the image. It's not so important. But anyway, under these conditions, your function must be linear. So this is not very elegantly posed, but this captures a lot of theorems like the one I said before, or sort of like the one I said before, that bijections taking a certain class of very simple geometric objects to another class of maybe the same objects or different objects, it must be linear. So this captures a lot of such examples. Here are some examples of what you can take out of this theorem. So for example, no non-affine bijection maps triangles onto triangles bijectively, but not all triangles which don't include certain n plus one directions, in directions which are different than these pre-chosen n plus one directions. There was this conjecture that the same is true for all triangles, so that you can't find the non-affine bijections which take triangles to triangles, every triangle to a triangle. And I thought it was a conjecture until sort of yesterday. I saw this paper of Li and Wang which proves it, though I haven't looked at it too much, and I haven't told Richard about it either, but it's probably known. Okay, like I said, it's pretty easy to show that that circles to circles are mapped only with affine with affine maps, ellipses to ellipses, and also circles to surfaces of strictly convex bodies. The only maps which take circles into surfaces of strictly convex bodies are affine maps. Okay, and this comes from this is written twice here. I'm not sure. This is a theorem of Gaudner. This is part of these theorems of Gaudner and Maldin. Okay, I think I've confused you enough, so I will do more in the next lecture, which is about multiplicative transforms and about the Fourier transform, and also a little bit about the derivative transform, and also a little bit about stability. So all this will be tomorrow if you will come. Thank you.